from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's spring, and as our gardens begin to come back to life, we'll look at a growing movement to preserve the vast variety of tomatoes and zucchini and peppers and other fruits and vegetables that big supermarkets may not sell and garden stores may not stock. It starts with seeds. More than 300 seed libraries have sprouted up across the country to help gardeners find and share seeds, plants that thrive in their towns, their climate, their soil. This hour, On Point, biodiversity, local flavor, and the populist push for hometown seed libraries. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you have a seed library in your town? Have you used it, checked seeds in and out? Does that make you a rebel, an outlaw, a seed saver? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll talk with the Hudson River Valley restaurateur Dan Barber, who thinks a lot about the local character of the produce he serves. You may never really have followed your garden all the way through to seed. Here's a little tutorial on saving lettuce seeds from the website migardener.com.
You're going to look for the seed pods that have the white fluff, almost like a dandelion top. And that's when you know they're really, really perfect. And the seed pod itself will be crusty and hard.
And you've got lettuce seeds, maybe you're a seed saver. With us now from Woodstock, New York, is Ken Green. In 2004, he set up the country's first seed library in a public library in Gardner, New York. He ran it for 4 years. He's now owner of Hudson Valley Seed Library. Ken Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Flagstaff, Arizona, is Belle Starr. She and her husband, Bill McDormand, founded Seed School in 2010 with courses on the history and science and business and craft of seeds and seed saving. They boast more than 600 graduates. This month, they'll be holding classes in Buell, Idaho, in Tucson, in Phoenix. Belle is co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, whose mission is to build a community of people who preserve and grow seeds. Belle Starr, thank you very much for being with us from Flagstaff.
What an honor to be here, Tom. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
It's great to have you. Ken, jump in first and explain to us, what on earth is a seed library exactly?
Well, there's no exactly to it, which is one of the great things about seed libraries. When I started the seed library when I was still a librarian and gardener, I was really seeing a lot of similarities between what was happening with seeds and the way that we share books and stories in a library. And I decided to add seeds to the library catalog so that people could check out the seeds just like checking out a book. And of course, at a library, you're expected to bring back your book after you check it out so that other people can share in the ideas, the stories, the imagination, the knowledge that we all want to share through the library. And so I asked that people would bring back seeds to the library that they saved from the plants that they grew. So that was our initial version. Today, you were talking about there's close to or over 300 seed libraries all over the country. They all do it a little bit differently because just like a library, libraries reflect their communities and the interests of the people in their communities. And so there's a lot of diversity with how seeds are shared through libraries.
Belle, what is the point of it exactly? I mean, I've seen these magnificent seed catalogs. They're fun to thumb through in the winter. They seem to have a bazillion kinds of seeds for all kinds of vegetables and plants. Why a seed library when you can just reach out, go online, get a catalog, order what looks like many different kinds of seeds?
Well, it's really about community resiliency and diversity and bioregionalism. When you save seeds from something you've grown where you live, you're taking the best from this season and transferring it into the next. When you save the seeds and then grow the seeds, you can have this beautiful interaction with your seeds and your plants that you don't get when you pick up a glossy seed catalog and order your seeds from somewhere else, with which oftentimes are coming from thousands of miles away and have nothing to do with your specific region. So you can choose for things like drought tolerance, insect resistance. It worked on the north side of my building in rocky soil.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the most important thing to select for and to interact with is flavor. And we're just not getting flavor anymore from these industrial vegetable seeds that we purchase often. And that's not to discredit any seed catalogs. It's a very complicated circumstance. And one of the things we teach in seed school often is just learning this hierarchy of the seed industry, so you can figure out where you want to enter into it and become a good seed steward. That's what we promote extensively at the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. In fact, we're assembling a network of seed stewards so that we can really enhance the whole idea of seed diversity and seed sovereignty and security region by region. Ooh, so important.
You've got a lot of ideas tucked in there. There must have been a time, Belle, when everybody was a seed saver. I mean, we didn't always online catalogs or any other kind of catalog.
Oh, my gosh. This goes back, well, it goes back 10,000 years. But for this country, the most patriotic thing you could do is save a seed. Thomas Jefferson was one of our best seed savers. He brought Piedmont rice back from Italy. He was really he really emphasized the need for us all to save seeds. Abraham Lincoln signed the Morrill Act that created the land grant universities, and that really set forth this idea that we need local resiliency. And part of that land grant university mandate was to grow things that worked in your area. Our government at the turn of the last century was giving away 1.1 billion packets of seeds region by region, not so that we would be dependent on these seed packets, but so that we would take these seeds, adapt them to where we live, and then grow them out and save them for free. 1.1 billion packets of seeds. And of course, that was gutted by the American Seed Trade Association in 1924. Why? Because there was the need and the idea that we could actually create commerce out of this and sell seeds.
Ken Green, do seed savers act as sort of curators of seed? I mean, I grew up planting and harvesting. By the time I was there on the farm, most of the crop seed would have been commercially purchased. Livestock, though, you'd carefully select what would be breed stock. You'd choose your best to breed for the next generation. Is it the same with seed savers? Do you take the seed from the best tomato, the best zucchini?
Absolutely. And where our diversity came from, you know, when we talk about heirloom varieties and people look back to what people before us were growing and what's been passed down generation to generation, that idea of what is the best or what is the tastiest or what is the most beautiful is a very personal opinion. And it's very subjective. And so that diversity that we had that we've been losing over the years, because of consolidation of seed resources and because of the narrowing of what's available through these catalogs of the larger seed companies, that diversity, to continue that, we need to continue to have backyard seed savers, on-farm seed breeders, and small regional seed companies like us, because now the Hudson Valley Seed Library is a seed company as well. We need that in order to start to increase the diversity again so that the tomato that I'm saving seed from that I think is amazing, I can start to share, and you can start doing the same, and we can all share those with each other.
Ken, why do the big corporate seed purveyors lead to a narrowing of options? Why would that be?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons for it. One is that the bigger you are, the more you have to think about the nation and more general characteristics for seed traits. So you stop selecting for or breeding for specific regions, and you take the seeds and you think, well, where is the easiest, cheapest place to grow these seeds in the world? It might be a labor issue. It might be a disease pressure issue. And so you start growing all of those types of seeds in one area rather than having people in all different regions saving those seeds. So even though it seems like maybe there's a lot of diversity, all of the brassicas are coming from one area of our country. All of the beans are coming from another area. And so we've lost those regional adaptations. But the other thing is that we don't really have transparency in the seed industry. So multiple seed companies are actually buying seeds from some of the same large seed resources. So it appears like there's diversity because you get all of these glossy seed catalogs in the mail, but maybe a lot of them are getting seeds from the same places. Whereas when you get seeds from us through seedlibrary.org, you know that you're getting seeds from seed growers who, like you said, are actually curating the collection in some way, making really careful, conscious, sustainable, and responsible decisions about where our seeds come from, what our seed dollars are supporting, and increasing the diversity of what's available.
Very locally attuned. Bellstar, we'll talk about this more, but in some ways, you guys are rebels or outlaws. I mean, there's a lot of regulation that goes on in this country around seeds and how they're distributed, sold, who can do that, what's going on there. These seed libraries have run into governmental opposition, Bell.
Well, you know, some of them have, not all of them actually. There's just been a few so far. And there's, you know, there's a response to that. There's quite a movement that's coming up to address the issues that we're being, you know, that the seed libraries are being accused of. The nature of the situation is that State Department, Department of Agriculture reps are trying to overlay business laws on a practice that has been going on for, you know, 10,000 years that allows us to really create this community resource. They're trying to treat seed libraries as businesses. And that's just not the circumstance. There's nobody selling seeds. We're exchanging, like if you were doing it in your living room.
And maybe doing it through the public library in your town. Ken may be selling some. Bellstar and many others using seed libraries. Go in, get some seeds, grow your crop, take back some seeds, and on it goes. It's local. You get biodiversity. You get the flavor, of the terroir. Bell, please stand by in Flagstaff. Ken Green in Woodstock, New York. The Little John Denver and homegrown tomatoes here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What a life be without homegrown tomatoes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about seed libraries, local collectors, growers, gardeners looking to take back and share the country's seed stock to make it local, to keep it diverse, to taste some good old-time flavors. Bellstar is with us today. She and her husband, Bill McDormand, founded Seed School in 2010, been involved with a lot of seed library work. She's co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. Ken Green is with us from Woodstock, New York. In 2004, he set up the country's first seed library at a public library in Gardner, New York. Now he owns and runs Hudson Valley Seed Library, sells seeds to nurseries and botanical gardens and online gardeners. People get really passionate about this, very worked up about seeds and vulnerability. Here's a little bit from the 2014 documentary, Open Sesame, The Story of Seeds, looking at threats to our seed supply from the trailer here.
We're right on the edge right now. If we don't start collecting this stuff within the next 10 years, it's going to be gone.
Seeds are like the keys.
Do we want to be the links, or do we want to be the people that broke the link?
The real crime is that you forgot you're in control. That you have an infinite power in a handful of seeds.
Bellstar in Flagstaff, Arizona. That last voice you heard was your husband, Bill McDormand. And we heard early on, we're right on the edge right now. The edge of what, Bill?
Oh, Tom, I have to just catch my breath. I'm a little emotional right now. That movie was such a pinnacle in our lives when we were at a seed conservation organization in Tucson, and the producer came down and spent a week with us at seed school, and at the end of that week was so moved. We had a closing circle. We pass out the corn instead of the talking stick, and we asked Sean Kaminsky to talk about his experience, and he said, well, I came to make a movie, but I'm going to go home. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to start a small regional seed company. I mean, the seeds are so powerful. What we've lost is this connection. We've lost the power, the magic, the understanding that we can do this, that there's this interface with seeds that is beyond lab coats in laboratories dissecting DNA and inserting genes. This is primordial. This goes back, you know, 10,000 years. It's a part of rituals and traditions in tribes and seasonal cycles. It's these little switches that come on when you start interacting with seeds and that whole process. And that's what we're losing, not to mention the flavor and the regional adaptation and the community building There's just so much at stake by giving over this to, quote, the authorities or the people in charge, which obviously has gotten us into a lot of trouble.
You've got a philosophical take on this. I see you've written, "Our freedom to steward our own seeds is an inalienable right as fundamental as life itself." Is this about taste? Is it about regional appropriateness? Is it about resiliency? I don't know, at some level, survival. We've all heard about that seed storage place. We've talked about it on this show. Up in, is it northern Norway, where they've got seeds tucked away against a disaster so we could grow our way back? Do seed libraries have a role in that?
The Svalbard Seed Bank,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Is a very different approach to ensuring that we have seeds for the future than a seed library. What seed libraries really do is they keep seeds in the hands of the people. They keep them growing and they keep them alive. A seed bank like the one that you're talking about in Norway is more of a insurance policy so that if there are major disasters, there is a protected seed source to draw on at that time. So they're really two very different approaches to preserving seeds. But it's important to have a diversity of ways that we share seeds and we protect seeds. And, you know, we're talking about a lot of big issues. And sometimes when I'm giving a lecture or a presentation and I'm talking about genetic engineering and I'm talking about loss of genetic diversity and I'm talking about, you know, all these big things, and it can get a little bit overwhelming. The power of seed and what's really, to me, the most amazing thing about being a seed saver is these big global issues that make us feel really small and powerless, we can take that power back through seed. And there actually is a way to do something about these issues just by getting involved, become learning how to save seeds, going to seed school, purchasing your seeds from small seed companies like us that are actually producing our own seeds. And so I've kind of changed my approach to teaching about seeds and teaching about these issues. And I really think what seed libraries do for communities and what we're all trying to do is celebrate seeds and honor seeds. And one of the ways that we do that now is we commission artwork. So each time we have a new variety, whether it's an heirloom variety that we're excited about or a new open pollinated variety that we think is going to be great for people's gardens, we send out a call for art and we find artists to interpret each variety in our seed catalog. And so each pack, instead of having one of those stock photos that's been airbrushed or touched up the way that, you know, fashion models are to look like something that's not achievable for us, we want people to think about the stories of the seeds and where seeds come from and what they really mean and the cultural value of seeds, and to really approach their gardens through that cultural lens rather than just the commodity of seed.
That's great. You and the Grateful Dead commissioning cover art here. I want to talk, before we get too far in here, I want to know, do they taste better, these veggies? Do they grow better? But lots of callers for you. Jason in Rochester, New York. Jason, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to comment briefly about the basic, like, integral, you know, genetic diversity that you're preserving with these seed libraries. And you know, you start to talk about this monoculture and the homogeny of big business and all of these, you know, vegetables and fruits becoming one and the same. And, you know, on a basic genetic level, when everything is the same, you know, some disease comes along or some pestilence and now everything is vulnerable. Whereas if you have these seed gardens and you preserve this genetic diversity, you know, you talk about having, you know, different variations, and maybe this tomato is more resistant. And, you know, so I was wondering if your guest could comment on the, you know, preserving the genetic diversity and how that can help to protect against, you know, calamities, I guess.
Yeah, Jason, let us do it. Bellstar, presumably even the big corporate seed producers are worried about strength and resilience, but there's another factor that comes in here.
Well, you know, we've all heard the saying, the strength of any ecosystem is its diversity. There's extreme wisdom in having things diversified to protect against pestilence or climate change or any issues that crops invariably will come up against, all these different issues. So those kinds of things are really, really important to have deep diversity. You know, as Ken said, the issues are so incredibly complicated. It's sometimes really hard to figure out where to enter into a conversation. What we like to say is we don't try to fight, you know, these big agribusinesses, especially since they own and control the food system. We're just trying to create a parallel reality. We want to take it out of the context of huge, which is mostly a scale issue when we're talking about seed libraries and large agri companies. You know, we want to take it out of a large perspective and bring it into a small one. When we talk about seed libraries and regional diversity, we have a mantra, and it's small and local, small and local. That's when you can really work on your own particular ecological niche and have, as Wes Jackson from the Land Institute says, eyeballs on acres or eyeballs on backyards. You know, we want that intimate relationship. We can go to the store, we can purchase all our stuff, or we can grow some of it and have that relationship with our food and select for things that taste better. Yes, we think it does taste better.
Let me go to Lake Linden, Michigan. Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is that I know that when you plant a seed, you get a product that is faithful to that seed. But if you have other varieties, you run the risk of cross-pollination, and the seeds from that may not be true to what you took. How do these libraries control the genetic purity of what they loan out?
That's a very good question. Of course, you've got self-pollinating plants, you know, beans and lettuce, tomatoes, peas. They've got male and female in the same flower, probably reproduce pretty directly, Ken. But open pollinating plants, you know, corn, squash, pollen flying around, how do you keep it pure or consistent, Ken?
Well, it's a great question, and I love when people want to learn more. For backyard seed savers or people who are producing seed, there's different ways of approaching this. But over the last 10 years that we've been growing seeds in a very small space on our little farm, we've really experimented and learned that almost any crop, you can find a way to grow it in a smaller space and produce high quality seed and ensure that it's not cross-pollinating.
So even open pollen, are you bagging the pollen, or how are you doing that?
So there's a few different approaches. One thing we do is we do caging, or we do hoops with row cover on them, and that's to prevent insects from visiting, say, a sweet pepper and a hot pepper that we have growing that we wouldn't want them to cross. We want the sweet pepper to stay sweet. We want the hot pepper to stay hot. So creating that barrier is one way we do it. We also do isolation through timing to make sure that two different plants that would normally cross-pollinate are flowering at different times. So that prevents cross-pollination.
But how do you know that everybody who uses your seed library is as careful, conscientious, skilled as you?
Well, that's part of where the diversity of seed libraries comes in. There are some seed libraries that are really teaching people the skills that they need to know variety by variety, family by family, to make sure that the seeds that are being shared haven't cross-pollinated. And Belle, maybe you want to speak to this a little bit too, because I know there's a phrase that Bill likes to use, eat your mistakes. Is that right? Is that what he says?
Well, everything we have was created by mistakes, yes. And that's actually the beauty. That's the beauty of having this local agriculture and this relationship with our seeds. If I could just jump in really quickly.
Yeah.
When we were in Tucson, we had a master gardener come up to us and say, actually, she walked up to Bill and said, Bill, we got a real problem. And he said, yeah. She said, people are starting to check in seeds. And he said, okay, that's what you're supposed to do. And she said, but we don't know what they're checking in.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, so... You know, we that's the whole role of a seed library. You know, you start to check things out. People get to know the players. You start selecting seeds from those you know who grow well. And then the educational overlay is like key to the whole process. That has to be part of this experience of learning how to save seeds. So we want mistakes. We want, and you'll know too that, or you should know that most seed libraries, when they start up, and this is based on Rebecca Newburn's website from the Richmond Seed Lending Library, who takes you step by step through how to do this, by the way, that she always recommends, and so do we, start with the easy vegetables, the ones that are self-pollinating, that generally don't cross. We never say never in biology, but that would be, you know, that's your tomato, lettuce, peppers, beans, and peas. Generally, they don't cross, so you've got a pretty good chance of getting something that's, quote, you know, true to type. But we don't hang out in that place of, like, that's an industrial overlay, in our opinion. That's more from a different perspective. We, you know, let's have fun. We love what we call playful plant breeding.
Peter Piper peckled peppers thing.
Thank you.
I want to bring Johnny Zook in. He joins us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's the seed program supervisor in the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture. Johnny Zook, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi.
I have the sense from what I've read out of your department that you're not entirely enthusiastic about how all this works, that you're looking to keep this within a scheme of regulation. Why is that important, Johnny?
Well, actually, we're not looking to keep it in a scheme of regulation.
Well, I'm reading here a letter from you from 1 year ago saying you require all distributors to purchase a seed license. That sounds like the beginning of regulation to me.
Yes, and the way the seed library was functioning, it was functioning as a seed distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And we met with them, and we asked them what their goals were and what they were trying to do, and out of that meeting, we developed protocols that if they follow these protocols, they do not get classified as a distributor and therefore do not fall under the purview of the law.
What about when harvested seeds are being returned to the library? Your letter says they need to be tested under the AOSA rules for testing seed. Is that right?
If the library is going to collect seeds and redistribute those seeds and publicize to the public at large that they are a source of seed,
which is pretty much what they're designed to do, I guess.
Right. And if they're going to follow that, they do get classified as a distributor, and then they would have to follow two sections of our Seed Act, which would require a seed license, which was $25 a year, and then they would have to have the seeds tested for proper labeling, which would become burdensome to a smaller library, and we understand that. So that's why we met with them and developed a protocol, which changes the behavior slightly. But we felt, and the library agreed, that they could still attain their goals, but it doesn't, in this case, then they don't fall under the preview of the law. So in Pennsylvania, we've never shut anyone down, and we've never gone after them saying, you know, you have to do this. We worked with them to see if there's a way that they can continue and we can stay consistent with the application of our seed law.
Johnny Zook, I'm really glad you're with us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Please stand by there if you would. Ken Green in Woodstock, New York. Bill Starr in Flagstaff, Arizona. Pete Seeger singing the garden song right here. This is On Point.
Plant your rose short or long, season with a cheerful song. Mother Earth will make you strong if you give her loving care.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
Gonna mulch it deep and low, gonna make it fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, please bless these seeds I sow. Please keep them safe below till the rain come tumbling down.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about seeds and seed libraries, local collectors, growers, gardeners looking to take back and share the country's seed stock to make it local, to keep it diverse, to taste some good old-time flavors. You check it out from the seed library in the classic form. You grow your crop. You take some seeds back for the next, much like a book lending library. You can join us this hour with Johnny Zook. He's seed program supervisor in Pennsylvania's Department of Agriculture. Bill Starr is with us from Flagstaff, Arizona, co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. She teaches with her husband, Bill McDormand, at the in the seed school they founded. Ken Green is with us. He set up the country's first seed library in a public library in Gardner, New York, back in 2004. He's now owner of Hudson Valley Seed Library. Lots of response online here. Amos says, we have seed parties, a night with friends, garden talk, seed swap, so much fun. Kent says, absolutely necessary. Please help these to exist freely. Karen writes to us, WWMD or WWMS, what would Monsanto do or say? We'll ask, let's get a call or two first. Kate in Littleton, Massachusetts. Kate, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well.
Good. I have a baby in arms, so you might hear her.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's from an embryo.
My own little sprout. I coordinate a seed library here in Littleton, Massachusetts. We're part of a community farm. And what I wanted to talk about was what a big community component there is to a seed library. We're not looking at this so much as trying to save the world or, you know, even necessarily make a great big political statement. What we're trying to do is to bring gardening back into our own backyards, bring people together talking about it, get them excited about getting their hands in the dirt. So we see the seed library as kind of a tool or a vehicle to get back to something a lot more basic, a lot more stable. And we've been really surprised at how well-received this has been in our town. People that you never would have expected have been very excited about getting involved, about hearing about it.
And Kate, did your group check out seeds and check them back in after you've grown your crop?
They do. We we have a core group of people that understand seed saving, look through who our returns are from, what kind of planting methods they used, whether they observed isolation distances and, you know, population densities.
Yes.
And then we will select from our returns the seeds that we feel like were planted with good, that would probably be good solid seeds to come back into the library.
Kate, I can hear your pleasure in it, and I love the way you describe it, sort of getting connected to to the cycle of life there and to each other through seed sharing and seed library there. Good luck with the papoose there. Let me get one more if I may. Thank you, Kate. Karen in Columbia, South Carolina. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm well. What do you know, Karen?
David Shields. The name is important because David Shields here in South Carolina, he's a professor at the University of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And he has done more work than probably anybody else in this region on finding those varieties and those items, locating them, bringing them to the attention of people, and saving them.
Like what, Karen? Like what,
Bradford watermelons grown in Sumter, South Carolina by the Bradford family. They continue to grow them. He was not aware of them. He tracked them down and publicize their watermelons, which means the seeds get saved.
Yeah.
And, of course, Carolina gold rice, probably the most important crop in South Carolina and along the East Coast for many, many years, going back into the 1700s. It's back. Sea Island red peas. The seeds were saved by African-American people who live along the coast of South Carolina, often called the Gullah people, but they grew Sea Island red peas, they saved the seeds, and now we're finding them again and selling the product so that there's a cycle that will increase. Benny seed, brown Benny seed, brought from Africa, grown in South Carolina, almost disappeared. It's back. Carolina African peanuts. The seeds for those were found at the North Carolina State University seed repository had gone completely unnoticed until David did the research, looked for them for 5 years, found them in North Carolina.
I love it. I love that litany. I love the whole sound of it. I can almost taste it. I have to ask while we have time, Ken, you hear Johnny Zook's concern about distributing seeds and the kind of permitting that they want to have happen there in Pennsylvania. He hasn't shut anybody down, but can seed libraries work with this kind of state oversight and do what you think they ought to do, Ken?
Well, first I want to address the caller. One of the amazing things about seed libraries and one of the wonderful things that's happened in the 10 years that we've been doing this is people come forward with all of these amazing varieties that have almost disappeared or been forgotten. They donate seeds to us. We grow them out. We see what they're like. We do whatever selection work needs to be done to bring them back and to share them with gardeners. And that's part of the importance of seed libraries and what they can accomplish for communities and also for the nation to make sure we have this diversity. And so when we're thinking about seed laws, you know, the seed company part of us, we are in compliance with the Federal Seed Act. It's important. It's an important law for protecting agriculture and our farmers.
But I'm asking about seed libraries,
right.
Maybe even in
so
public libraries. I'm reading in Minnesota they can charge a fine $7,500 per day if you're not in compliance, and many seed libraries can't afford to be.
Exactly. And so I believe, and Rebecca and Bell and other people who are involved in this, who are all going to be meeting soon at the International Seed Library Forum in Arizona that's coming up in May, this will be one of the big topics that's being discussed. But seed laws should not be for regulating communities that are sharing seeds with each other. Seeds are a commons, and the seed laws really weren't drafted or intended to regulate seed sharing between people within communities. They are about regulating the commercial seed trade. And so applying those standards to seed libraries, community seed exchanges, community seed banks, is really inappropriate. It's a unfair application of the law.
Johnny Zook,
really,
let me ask you about
sense.
That, if I may. Johnny, what's the downside if you have seed libraries unregulated or, you know, exchanging seeds? Bell Starr writes, you know, the freedom to steward our own seeds is an inalienable right as fundamental as life itself. What's the downside, Johnny?
Well, there could be. When I first went into this, I thought there would be a lot of downsides. But a lot of the people involved in this are very well educated, and they do a good job on this. But I would like to see an educational component involved in these that inform people of noxious weed laws, both on the state level and the federal level, and different look-alike seeds and things like that. But keep in mind, if they're not functioning as a distributor, they're not going to fall under the purview of the law.
But they want to distribute. They want to distribute and collect, and distribute and collect.
Well, yes. And you can do it in such a way that it's on a personal level. It's on a very, person-to-person interaction. Or you can do it on a way in which you are publicizing to the public at large, I am a source of seed, an ongoing source of seed. Come to us, we will provide.
If you're a seed library in a public library, that's fairly public, I'd say, isn't it?
Can I jump in?
Sure, Bill.
Sure. We've been in contact. We had some back and forth emails with Dr. Zook, and we asked about some of the concerns. And one of the concerns, of course, is seed-borne diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to date, there have been no... there's no recorded, no recorded history, I guess, of any kind of issues or problems with backyard gardening seeds. So, you know, we think that that's something that definitely needs to be looked at in terms of regulating a problem that doesn't exist. The other issue, I believe, with what's been worked out in Pennsylvania is you cannot return seeds to the library. That sort of trumps the whole notion of what a seed library has been created to do.
Johnny, it sounds like there's still a nut here, an irreducible seed of a kind of conflict. Are these going to be outlaws?
Well, returning the seed to the library does reduce some of the fun factor to it. But the ability to organize, the ability to track, the ability to still develop and grow local ecotype varieties is still there. It may be a little harder, but it is not completely gone. And I understand the funness of it is reduced, but I don't accept that it can't be done.
Johnny Zook is Seed Program Supervisor in the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, joining us today from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Zook, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dan Barber joins us right now from Pocantico Hills, New York. He's chef and co-owner of the Blue Hill Restaurants in Manhattan, Pocantico Hills. His book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food, just out in paperback. Dan Barber, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So you've been writing about how the farm-to-table movement hasn't really changed or reworked our food, the way our food is grown and raised and distributed. Is seed saving, could seed libraries be the thing that get us closer to local, resilient, organic?
Well, the short answer is yes. I'm an enormous proponent because, if anything, I mean, it was said already, but the community engagement that happens with these seed libraries and the excitement and enjoyment and pleasure that go along with the activity is you know, paramount. So that is very important. My interest, while invested in making sure that seed libraries continue to grow and have the kind of influence they've had and more so in the future, is also to take those seeds and modernize them and in that way utilize breeders, many of whom work for us in the land-grant university system, and take those genetics that we all want from the past, because generally if they're seeds that were saved from the past, they taste better. That's sort of a fundamental rule.
Why?
Because why else would you save them? I mean, we throughout history, we didn't save seeds because they had a positive ecological impact. We saved them because people enjoyed them.
Yeah.
And we saved them because they had good pest resistance. We saved them because they had good yields.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, the history of seed saving is about pleasure and enjoyment and nutrition, all of which are one and the same subject. I guess the problem I have, and I'm parsing this out maybe to be a little controversial, and I repeat, I'm very much in favor of everything these callers are talking about. My issue, as you know, as a chef who's got a skin in the game here, is to look at these seeds both for their potential to continue to push this movement forward, this local food movement forward, but also to take those genetics and modernize them to even better effect, better flavor, better pest resistance, better locality. And that means taking those seeds and marrying them with other varieties and changing them. Because look, these seeds that are in our libraries, they were made from breeders who were continuing to do that.
Yep.
That's the history of seed breeding, is that every year you were continuing your crop and you were either selecting or marrying different varieties to get outcomes that were increasingly better. And so what I don't like about the farm-to-table movement is this kind of fetishism with heirlooms and old repatriation. Though those flavors are important, and the Southern example is probably paramount for our history of food culture, but also equally important, if we were sitting here talking, if we had the luxury of having or the fantasy of having breeders that you know were breeding 100 years ago and 200 years ago, they would all say, "Well, why are you supporting the breeds that we never stopped? You should take these genetics and utilize modern breeding and push them along." I'm not talking about genetic modification. I'm talking about even old world.
I've got it, Dan. If I may, let me put that to Bell Star. Bell, do you see a tension between breed them, modernize them when it comes to seeds, and save them?
Absolutely not. There, I love what Dan said, and it's an honor to be on with Dan. You know, a couple of examples of what Dan is speaking about, I believe, are Dark Star Zucchini and Shiraz Beets that started with some, you know, old world stock, and I believe were breeded by Organic Seed Alliance. I mean, there's folks out there and organizations that have been working on this for years and years to take some of the best from these heirloom varieties, and heirloom is a very loaded term, by the way, but to use the genetics and then start breeding for specific outcomes. And so there's nothing wrong. I mean, that's part of the process. That's how we got painted mountain corn that is distributed by a fabulous seed company, Fedco. A gentleman's been breeding for 40 years, selecting all kinds of Native American corns and mixing them together. That mix is called a Grex. I mean, there's so many playful, wonderful things you can do, and it does provide a service. You know, we need more ingenuity and more creativity in our plant breeding. Absolutely.
Can I jump in there real quick?
Yes, Ken, please. Yes.
Because there's sort of a term that Organic Seed Alliance, I'm on the board of directors there, and the work we're doing, there's a term that we've been using to talk about what Dan was talking about, which is heirlooms of tomorrow. And it's this idea that we need to take all of this amazing genetic heritage and the cultural heritage that's been passed on to us and make sure that we're creating the heirlooms of tomorrow that 100 years from now, people will look back and say, these are worth preserving, these are worth sharing, and that future generations will continue to make these changes and pass on these seeds.
A fascinating world. It gets me ready to really get out in the garden and do the work. We can hear some of the tension at the same time with the system that we've got now, but a kind of people's seed push here. Ken Green with the Hudson Valley Seed Library. Thank you so much for being with us this hour, Ken.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Barber at Blue Hill Restaurants in Pocantico Hills, New York. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Bell Starr, the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance and Seed School in Flagstaff, Arizona. Bell, thank you very much for being with us today.
A pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks to you. Good luck planting. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.